are listening to a free version of The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, July 23rd, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, writing in the American Prospect, Harold Meyerson, how the South drives the low-wage economy. Also on the program today, John Kerry hits back at Iran deal critics. More information on Sandra Bland as the investigation as to what happened to her continues, and really only more questions arise. Meanwhile, Donald Trump, both the bane and really, I don't know if he's the king. He may be the prince. I mean, Rush Limbaugh is still the king of the Republican Party. Announces that if the RNC doesn't start treating him nicer, he may run as a third party candidate. Meanwhile, a huge victory in New York State for the people who started the fight for 15 a couple of years ago now. Minimum wage workers at fast food restaurants just got their bump. And we'll also talk about the legislation that Bernie Sanders and the Congressional Progressive Caucus proposed yesterday on a day when federal contract workers were striking. Story for Matt about how new dads get fatter. Believe me, I've lived it. I'm still living it. Old dads get fatter too, apparently.
I look forward to it.
And we will revisit Rand Paul's flat tax. We've addressed it in the past, but now he is taking a chainsaw and cutting up the tax code as a... I'm not going to get too far into this because I want to get to Harold Meyerson. We've got a lot of things to do. But the level of desperation now of the Republican candidates in the days coming up to the to get into the debates and to become relevant. Michael asked me, why do you think Rick Perry is coming out so hard against Donald Trump, saying that Donald Trump will destroy the Republican Party? And I'm like, well, because you haven't said the words Rick Perry without saying the words Donald Trump in 2 months, and nobody else has either. That's why he's talking about Donald Trump. We will also give you an update. Apparently, there's some changes at MSNBC. It appears, and I haven't seen full-on confirmation of this, but it appears that the Ed Schultz show has been canceled, that The Cycle has been canceled, and that Alex Wagner's show has been canceled. This happening, and that Chuck Todd is going to be back into their 5 o'clock lineup or something to that effect. This also coming the day after Chris Hayes. I like to say friend of show, Chris Hayes. I think that's legitimate. won two or was nominated for two Emmy nominations for specials they did. Well-deserved, if you ask me. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Harold Meyerson. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Harold Meyerson, American journalist and opinion columnist, writing in for this piece in the American Prospect, How the South Drives the Low-Wage Economy. Harold, welcome to the program.
Always good to be here, Sam.
Yeah, I loved your piece because we interviewed Edward Baptiste on the program a couple of months ago. We had booked Sven Bechart. We had a complication, and we're not going to get him until the end of the summer or the beginning of the fall. So I thought it would be great to talk about this because you really synthesized some major themes of these two books. And it is, and went further in a lot of respects. But let's start the idea that the South is driving the low wage economy is in many respects, as you write, or in all respects, a replay of history.
Well, yes. What it specifically replays, and I had read both those books, the Burkfist and the Baptist, which are both really important books, which basically make the case that cotton was really the key to the rise of the sort of global production chain of the 19th century, of industrial capitalism. It was the American South that fed the material to the first real factories in Manchester, England. But it was, obviously at the time, it was a place where there were no wages paid. That was one of the essences of slavery. And what struck me in meeting several months ago, before I wrote this piece, with some German union leaders who, as a result of what the Germans call co-determination, which says that in any sizable corporation, the board of directors has to be split between worker representatives and management representatives. So some of these guys were actually board members of leading German corporations like Airbus and Daimler-Benz. And I was talking with them, and they were saying, well, we do the high value-added work here at Germany. We make the, most sophisticated parts. And then we look for some place where we can assemble all of these parts together as a car or an airplane cheaper than elsewhere. And what became clear was that given the productivity advantages that the United States has over the developing world, given that wages have been skyrocketing in China and have been either stagnant or declining in the United States, they had increasingly concluded that it was cheaper to make their cars and planes in Alabama and South Carolina and Mississippi and Tennessee than it was in China, which is kind of, a whoa moment, whoa. We're in competition with China. And then what occurred to me is, we have reverted to the same division of global labor that we had under slavery. The high value added work goes on elsewhere. And hello, American South, you are back again as the center of the low end of the production scale, and that was an interesting realization.
It's shocking, and I want to reiterate it just so that people caught this, because we hear the idea of like we're competing with China all the time. But this is like we're actually competing with China and winning. But what we're winning is that we actually, dollar for dollar in terms of productivity hour, are cheaper than China. That's
and
stunning.
This is actually predicted by some consultants and economists at the Boston Consulting Group like 4 years ago in 2011. They kind of, mapped out some economic trajectories and said, hey, we think that more business is going to be coming to the American South because it'll turn out to be cheaper than China. And they even said by 2015, which is when I was interviewing these board members at German corporations. And lo and behold, the Boston Consulting Group was right. We are competing with China on labor costs, which is should give us all a lot of pause.
And so are we seeing any benefits to this, right? I mean, isn't this like this is in many respects, conservative ideologues will say, well, this is the best news that we've had all day because finally we're going to have jobs are going to come home to America. The issue, I guess, at that point is like, wow, these are not good jobs.
Yeah, I mean, one of the paradoxes of this is even as the southern states have been adding these factories, wages actually continue to fall there. They've fallen in Alabama during the whole time period when Alabama has been, becoming the home to Daimler-Benz and Airbus and a bunch of other companies. So we have to remember that, among other things, there are five American states that have never passed a minimum wage law of their own, and they are Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, South Carolina, and Tennessee. I mean, this is one of the hardwired legacies of slavery, which we see all the time in all kinds of different ways, including, as we clearly have realized over the last year or two, police practices. But we see it in the economy, too. I mean, it's, the regional pattern in mutated form, to be sure, persists hundreds of years later. It's really a sobering realization.
What accounts? First off, let me before we get to what accounts for that. I mean, how is it that we have a situation? Okay, so we have a situation where more jobs are coming to Alabama, but wages aren't going up. Does that just mean that there's a tremendous amount of slack in the in the job market there? I mean, or in terms of the supply of labor, is it? You mentioned that there's no state minimum wage, so the basement is the floor is the federal minimum wage.
Yeah,
but there's. Does that indicate a slack in labor, or does that indicate that there are forces that suppress wages actively, or i.e. there is an absence of those forces that tend to raise wages, like unions, like...
The latter, mainly. I mean, here's one thing that depresses wages. A lot of these factories, certainly the Nissan auto factories in Tennessee and Mississippi, a lot of their workforce, and sometimes it's more than half the workforce, aren't actually employees. They're hired from temp agencies. That's a good way to, depress your wages and pay no benefits. So that's one factor. The anti-union right-to-work nature of the southern states is a clear factor. I mean, the rate of unionization of the entire private sector workforce in all the southern states is well beneath 5%. So 5% is really the functional equivalent of zero. So there are a whole lot of factors that are in play even when labor markets aren't really all that slack. Like I said, the South remains hardwired for a low-wage economy. I mean, if we want to think of it this way, slavery was a bit more or less a full-employment economy, That wasn't what depressed wages.
Right.
It was the whole racist, and all profits without paying any wages ethos of the pre-Civil War South.
What I also found, and I know we have only about another 10 minutes or so, but what I also found really fascinating about your piece is that it brought into clarity to me sort of the role of the federal government in basically championing a different perspective on labor that exists in the North. And it also, for me, you know, at the end of the piece, as you talked about President Obama entering by trying to sort of bridge this divide between red state and blue state and really, I guess, in many respects, South and the North, that those divides had deepened. And you also talk about this dynamic where we're starting to see these values begin to manifest themselves in Northern Republican held states like Michigan, like Ohio, like Wisconsin, where you see this. I don't want to be too hyperbolic here, but this disease of sort of like red state, Southern state labor perspective spread. Talk a little bit about why it's not being contained, why this contagion is not being contained in the way that it was, I guess, 100 years ago.
Sure. Well, this was another realization in which I thought there was a historical parallel. You remember, you know, Lincoln said that this nation cannot exist half slave and half free. It will become all one or all the other. And we still have this issue of two labor systems, what had been the Northern labor system and what had been the Southern labor system. And what we have seen in recent years is with the Republican Party nationally moving to a kind of radical right perspective, and partly this is also related to the increasingly non-diverse racial composition of the Republican Party. Governors like Scott Walker in Wisconsin and Snyder in Michigan and the successive governors of Indiana have enacted the kind of labor and racial laws we had associated mainly with the South, in particular right to work laws, and laws intended to suppress minority voting by producing requiring certain kinds of identification and so on. So, you know, as it were, the South is coming north. And again, I was reminded of the 15 years before the Civil War, when the geographic boundaries that had divided the slave South from the free North had begun to weaken. And things like the Fugitive Slave Act and the Dred Scott case were an attempt to, really keep the Northern system from expanding and giving the South more leverage. Well, those didn't work, eventually there was a civil war, but, the South is in many ways moving north today. And one of the ways we see that is that the wages and benefits of Northern workers in those industries that I mentioned before, like auto, aerospace, et cetera, have been falling, have been reduced, and getting closer to Southern levels. So instead of pulling the nation up, we're kind of pushing the nation down.
Am I wrong in this sense that to maintain... I mean, there's sort of a natural tendency. I mean, I can't help but think of like the South's labor practices as sort of like the Donald Trump of America in some way. Like, you know, Donald Trump seems to be this sort of magnet where everything sort of naturally flows in the Republican Party towards him. And if he takes a position, they all have to sort of gravitate towards that. There's obviously a natural tendency, I think, barring any type of intervention for capital to demand lower wages and to create lower wages and to do everything they can to maintain lower labor costs. And they're only prevented from doing so by, it seems to me, in the context of this country, in many respects, by federal intervention. At one point, we said slavery. Go ahead.
Yeah, by federal intervention or by unions. And, of course, unions, in a certain sense, required federal intervention
yes.
to win the National Labor Relations Act in 1935. But by the same token, worker mobilization was one of the factors behind the passage of the National Labor Relations Act. So it's a reciprocal relationship. But, yeah, it's the federal government or its workers themselves if they can amass enough power, which God knows they never have in the American South.
And I want to make even a finer point there, because it seems to me that as we have, you know, unions exist, yes, by worker power, but they cannot exist but for federal intervention, in the same way that corporations can't really exist without federal intervention. We have only, it seems to me, over the past 30, I mean, you could even go back, I guess, prior to that. But we have only, over the past 30 to 70 years, weakened the federal intervention in terms of allowing for unions and strengthened the federal intervention in terms of strengthening corporations.
Well, I mean, that's certainly true. And, of course, the Supreme Court has played a significant role in that and may continue to do that. But yes, obviously, and in the political process, certainly corporations and the wealthy now have more control over the electoral process, which means more control over what the government actually turns out, than they've had either since the Gilded Age or ever. So, yeah, this has been a decisive shift in federal policy ever since, after the Johnson administration.
So lastly, what do we do about this? I mean, do we need to demand more from our, federal? In other words, you know, was there enough demands, I think, you know, is one of the questions put on President Obama to enhance the power of unions or have we just gone beyond that? I mean, that even structural reform won't help us.
Well, I mean, no, structural reform always helps. The question is, how the heck do we get it? And certainly, I think what you see in what Bernie Sanders is saying and the response he's getting, and even in the moving left, really, of the center of the Democratic Party, which we see as Hillary Clinton begins to deal somewhat gingerly with these issues, what we're seeing is, I think, a renewed focus on how do we get a more fair and balanced economy, not to quote Fox News there, what it may take to do that. But that's a struggle for the long haul, and I'm afraid that's what we're in.
And, I can't tell you how much I appreciated the piece. It is in this month's American Prospect. We will link to it at majority.fm. Harold Meyerson, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Sam.
All right, folks. We only had Harold for a limited period of time today, but I really wanted to talk about it because I thought the piece was really fascinating. And it's definitely worth your reading. Relatively long piece. But it's not a novelette.
There's something about that where I was thinking about Bernie Sanders, and I don't know how he would do it, and I don't think you would necessarily talk about the South specifically, but the way that piece linked up the racial with the inequality issues, I don't know. There could be some interesting bridges there for him to start talking about his message and kind of broadening it.
I mean, I think that's definitely there, but. To me, what really became clear with this piece is the need for federal intervention. Now, I say this on a day where, or I should say yesterday, when in New York, the Department of Labor basically said fast food workers over the next 5 years, less, you will be getting $15 an hour. In New York City, that will happen faster.
brought up to $15 an hour. That's going to impact about 180,000 workers in New York State. Yesterday, on the steps of the Capitol with striking federal contracting workers, and by federal contracting workers, I'm talking about the federal government hires Foodco to provide the cafeteria food and workers. They hire Janico. I'm making up these names, incidentally. Janico. To provide janitorial services for federal buildings in Washington, D.C. They hire Landscape Co. to provide, you know what I'm saying. And what Bernie Sanders and the CPC were calling for was when the federal government issues these contracts, that one of the factors that they use in to determine whether or not Landscape Co., Food Co., Janico are eligible for a federal contract is if they pay their workers a living wage of $15 an hour. There's plenty of precedent for this, and we just choose whatever the number is we want. So, but with all that said, at the end of the day, we're going to need to see a more robust action on the part of the federal government. Now, we've seen, some of it. The National Labor Relations Board, once we got those people put on, there was a full quorum of commissioners. But we also need to see changes with the Supreme Court, frankly. I mean, we have this agency fees case that we spoke about earlier this month or in June, where to deal with the free rider issue of unions, where if you're in a union shop, you don't have to become a member of the union. You don't have to pay full union dues, but you do have to pay something to cover the costs of those people representing you and getting you more wages and more benefits. And in 2016, the Supreme Court will rule on whether or not that's still legal, whether they will overturn Abood versus Detroit or Detroit versus Abood. Let's not get picky, folks. I'm doing my best here. I don't have it in front of me. But let's just call it Abood. That's what they do, those lawyers. All right, before we go into the fun half, I want to play this clip of Elizabeth Warren just because, well, two things. One, to draw your attention to a couple of things, I guess. One is that there is an attempt by some, Elizabeth Warren being one of those, to get the Labor Department to change rules under ERISA. ERISA, of course, is the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of early 1970s, basically was put in place when, I can't remember what company it was that went under. U.S. Steel, I think it was. This is off the top of my head. There was a major industrial company that went under and took their pension plan with it. So people had paid into this pension for years, a defined benefit plan, and nothing left. And ERISA basically was a response to that, which basically said, look, you've got to fund your plan. You can't have these crazy projections as to what your investments are going to be returns. Because, if I put my money into, I could say to Nikki, like, oh, we're going to have millions of dollars in retirement. I'm putting away $10 a year, but I expect 25,000% returns each year. And so we're going to be loaded. That's basically the game that we see played with. We see it with states sometimes do it when they want to give tax cuts to people. They'll just say, like, we can underfund our pensions, and all we got to do is increase our optimism as to how much we're going to make in these funds. And ERISA basically put some standards on that. And also, I believe also in many cases created the I believe it created the Pension Guarantee Trust, which made companies basically provide some type of insurance at the end of the day for their pensions. Nevertheless, under ERISA, the Labor Department can require investment managers who advise on pension funds to actually provide advice that is in the best interest of those people who are participating in the pension fund or have a pension, as opposed to in their own best interests. Let me repeat that. There is hearings going on so that there is a regulation saying that investment advisors actually have to provide investment advice that benefits their client as opposed to primarily benefiting the person giving advice. That seems somewhat obvious, but that law does not exist now. So you should know that when you talk to your investment advisor about your pensions, that he's not obligated legally to give advice that's going to help you. He could be giving you advice that's going to help him or her, to be fair.
It's going to be great.
Yes.
See what I'm
Believe
saying?
Me, I'm giving you advice, and one of us is going to be sitting by the pool in our retirement. I promise you, one of us will be. Here is Elizabeth Warren. This happened on Tuesday. Primerica President Peter Schneider was invited to testify against a new proposed regulation designed, like I say, to protect retirement savings from investment managers who may think that really job number one is for them to profit. The Obama administration has estimated that Americans lose $17 billion a year from investment professionals who manage retirement accounts by prioritizing their own financial interests over those of their clients. It has proposed a simple solution, making it illegal. All right, so here is the exchange. It's long, but I want to play it for two reasons. One, so that you're aware of this dynamic. Three reasons. Two, you're aware of... because it always amazes me, like people go into business and have no compunction about basically effing over their customers. Like that's their business model. And three, it's fun to watch Elizabeth Warren tear a person like that apart in public.
Your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Acting Chairman. As we have discussed, it is now perfectly legal for retirement advisors to give advice that boosts their own incomes by selling lousy products to their clients. And according to the best available data, data that are not paid for by the industry, this bad advice costs Americans about $17 billion a year. The Department of Labor has proposed a rule that would put a stop to this retirement savings drain and require all investment advisors to put their customers first. Level playing field. Mr. Schneider, you're the CEO of Primerica, a large investment advisory firm, and you've testified today that the Department of Labor's rule is, and I think these are your words, complex and burdensome. And you've said that one thing that's, quote, critical to your success is that Primerica always operates in its clients' best interest. So I was interested to read a news report this morning that outlines lawsuits brought against your advisors in Florida. According to the article, at least 238 firefighters, teachers, and other career public workers who were near retirement age accused your company of providing bad advice that drained their retirement savings. And you did it by advising them to move their retirement savings out of a guaranteed government pension into riskier private investments. Now, Primerica was poised to make a lot of money, but only if you could convince Florida firefighters who were near retirement age to cash out their guaranteed pensions. So, Mr. Schneider, I just want to understand your company's advice in these cases. Do you believe that people like these firefighters from Florida who are near retirement and have secure pensions with guaranteed monthly payments should move their money into riskier assets with no guarantees just before they retire?
First of all, Senator Warren, I appreciate the promotion. I'm actually the president of the company, not the CEO.
Oh, okay.
And I'm familiar with the matter of which you speak, and it doesn't have any application to the rule before the committee, because in that particular case, none of those individuals were clients of Primerica.
All right, pause it. Now, okay, now she's going to rip into him for this, but I want to make it clear what he's claiming now. He's saying that these weren't clients of ours. They were potential clients of ours. So the advice we were giving them at that time was just like they were off the street. Like we were just yelling outside of our building, "Hey, guys, come in here. You're not a client of ours. We're not managing your money. We want to entice you to manage your money. And so you're not clients of ours now. So we're not under any legal obligation to tell you anything that would be in your best interest in the event that this law ever passes."
That's hook you with the bad advice, and then you pay us for the good advice.
There you go.
Just no compensation. But let me go.
Let's just stop right there, Mr. Schneider. The article didn't say the workers were your retirement clients. It says you gave them bad advice. And here exactly is the quote. "Once these workers retired and moved out of their government plans, Primerica agents stood to profit from managing their retirement assets. Had they stayed in the pension programs, retirees would have simply collected their monthly payments, leaving nothing for Primerica to manage and no commissions for Primerica agents to harvest." Now, my question is not how you were paid. My question is whether you think it is sound investment advice to encourage public employees to move their money out of their pensions and into riskier assets with no guarantees just before they retire.
So, Senator, in that particular matter, first of all, regulators looked at that. They found the firm had acted properly.
I'm going to stop you right there. The question about the regulators is the question about is it legal to do that, and that's exactly the problem we've got. It is legal to do that, and I think that's what the regulators say. It's legal. My question, once again, is about the advice that Primerica agents gave. Is it a good idea for firefighters on the front edge of retirement to move out of a guaranteed benefit plan that was going to cover them for all their lives and move into a risky investment that would make a lot of fees for your agents?
You know, each situation is really very different. If you are in a defined benefit plan and you're sick, what happens is, in the state of Florida, for example, were you to retire and then die 2 or 3 weeks later, you had no ability to leave your money to your loved ones.
I'm sorry, and so it's very specific. Are you suggesting that these 238 people were weeks away from dying, and that's why they all got this advice?
Well, Senator, the courts dismissed those cases, and frankly, this illustrates one of the problems.
Illegal activity. I think we've established that, Mr. Schneider, that no one broke the law. The question is whether the law should be changed.
Changed. Well, you know, it's very difficult. Maybe 238 weren't weeks away from death, but you never know. I mean, anybody could get hit by a bus at any time, don't you know? And also, there was a lot of those people that we met with, they had sniffles. Now, a sniffle, you know, particularly in down in Florida, where it can be very humid at times, that could turn into something, a respiratory infection. There's all sorts of different things that you're not contemplating, Senator. Honestly, we're just trying to keep people from dying. Unbelievable.
I have a more complicated job than you, Senator. Okay, so don't you... How dare you judge me?
Yes.
I mean, we're making medical diagnoses on the spot. We're anticipating the stock market. We're trying to keep families together.
You know, it's one thing to, do some type of medical examinations when you have a medical degree. But think of how hard it is for us who don't have a medical degree to perform these type of duties simultaneously while also planning on the potentialities of what could happen, financially speaking, to those people who have a medical disability problem.
But then again, I'm just the president, not the CEO.
That's right. I mean, it's a lot of this stuff is above my pay grade.
When I'm a CEO, we're going to start using astrology as well, Senator. You understand me with your
can you believe
your ivory tower?
That's the best answer he has. Like, they weren't sitting at the Primerica offices and saying, like, look, just remember, we have this whole thing where we're getting sued. And we have set aside $15.5 million in fiscal year 2014 to settle lawsuits like these. $15 million we set aside. This may come up. And if it does, you should have an answer. Well, how about if I just say, what if these people died?
Boom.
Boom.
You know what?
That's it.
Frank, you're on your way.
You don't think I need anything else? No. I mean,
she'll be
everybody
up.
Dies.
She'll be up there. She'll be all cocky with her liberal nonsense. You know, you just come out right out of left field. They could die.
Yeah, what if they die?
How about that? How about that? Bet you never thought about that. You big government projection.
I bet you didn't think about that one, Senator.
Yeah, because everybody lives forever.
Okay,
big government liberal immortalist. I get it.
You get older. Maybe you trip. You break your hip. You get an infection. You die. That, come on. All right, let's head into the fun half of the program. Folks, it is your memberships that make this show possible. The show could not, would not, will not, cannot exist without your support. You can become a member today at majority.fm. Now, look, this is why you should do it today, because you never know, you could die, and then your plan to become a member of the show, you wouldn't be able to do it. So all I'm saying is, let me give you some very good pension advice. If you want to add to your pension, become a member, and then
cash
something
out now
else
and
will
give
happen.
It all to us.
Exactly.
Because you're going to be really regretful when you think about that.
Here's
you could have
thing.
Been a Cedarista, and all of a sudden you're dead.
Here's the thing, folks. You've got your pension account. That's great. But what if you die? How will you use it? If you empty out your pension account now and use it to buy, you could become a Majority Report reporter for $10 a month. But let me introduce you to a special Sam Cedar Majority Report membership. Yes, there's the Majority Reporter. There's the Cedarista. There's the dirty effing hippie or the professional leftist or the French or the Sam Cedar where you actually get to be me. But we're going to add a special level of membership called the can't use it if you're not alive pension plan.
You know, I just realized that he's talking about firefighters who are retiring, like they're not going to be running into the burning buildings anymore.
right.
And you know, we've done the projections, and your risk of dying now that you're no longer a firefighter are actually going up.
Right.
So,
that's awesome.
You don't have the same protections. If you end up running into a building that's on fire, you're probably not going to be wearing your fireman suit. So,
probably lose some of your sort of instincts.
Folks,
more likely you'll get hit by a car.
Here's my point: when you invest all of your pension into a Majority Report special post-pension membership, you are guaranteed full access to the show. And under our new plan, your family, your remaining family members will also get full access to the show as long as they can figure out what your membership key was from your computer.
Because we can only give that key to you.
Right.
So if you were to die, they would be screwed, unless they knew it already.
Right. For our regular members, we don't allow that. But for you, if you become a Majority Report pension, post-pension member, so feel free. Believe me, this is the best. We only say this in your financial interests. So we have only one more year before this law comes into effect. And so we want to reiterate how important it is you do this now. Also, I'm not the CEO, just the president. Now,
Noah is the CEO.
Congratulations, Noah. For those of you who don't want to help your financial situation and don't want to participate in the post-pension level of the Majority Report membership, you can always get great coffee at justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Or if you insist on maintaining hold of your money and you purchase things on Amazon, you can do so at majorityreportkickback.com. Go there, click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, use that as your Amazon, buy all your crap. You won't notice any difference.
If you need any investment advice, Primerica.com, coupon code.
Exactly. Coupon code. Hey, we still got a year before we to rip you off. All right. We're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-2-whatever. Pick up the app, majorityapp.com. It's completely free. However... No, it's still free. All you got to do is put in your pension information.
Your Social Security number.
All these people are going to be getting a lot more calls for quote-unquote free Caribbean vacations.
That's right. All right, see you in the fun half.
We've got a timeshare to sell to you, too.
That's right.